You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The Jameses established themselves as one of the most prominent American intellectual families in the late 19th century, and their influence continues to this day. William James helped foster the young science of psychology with his writings and research, and his brother Henry wrote novels that remain an important part of the American canon. But what about their younger sister Alice, who was a sharp observer and witty writer in her own right and became a subject of her brother's writing? She suffered from illnesses for most of her life and died without ever marrying or seeing any of her work in print. Jean Strauss's biography, Alice James, won a Bancroft Prize when it was published in 1980, and it's recently been re-released by New York Review Books in a new edition that features a foreword by Colm Choi Bean. I'm very pleased that Alice James, a biography, has brought Jean Strauss to our show today. Hello.
As am I. Thank you very much.
You begin the book long before Alice was born by talking about her grandparents. Her grandfather became a wealthy man in the late 18th century. What did he do?
Just about everything that made money. He came from Ireland and went to upstate New York. He got involved in banking, real estate, canals. He was the first William James. He was called William of Albany within the family. He was highly successful entrepreneur.
And the James family was able to maintain that wealth into subsequent generations?
It did not keep filling up the coffer, but there was enough that he actually cut off several of his children. He had 13 children and was a very strict, stern Calvinist father who disapproved of a lot of the dissolute ways of his sons, including Henry James, who was the father of the Jameses we're about to talk about. And he cut them out of his will, and then the children contested the will, and it was successfully broken. And Henry James Sr. came out of that fray with property worth enough to yield him $10,000 a year, and he never worked at a conventional job a day in his life.
And then it was something that was fortuitous for the kids as well, because William probably would have had to do other things, at least initially, before he became famous, and Henry as well.
Mm-hmm. Henry, yes. William went to medical school. He became a psychologist and a philosopher, but I doubt that he began making any money till he was in his 40s. Henry was writing and was earning money as a writer, but not very much. So, yes, it supported this family of five children, in fact, and their father giving them what he called a sensuous education on both sides of the Atlantic.
This educational history is an important part of your book. He turned the household into an impromptu laboratory for experiments in child rearing and moral philosophy. What kinds of experiments?
Well, he felt his own childhood had been so blighted by his father and this stern Calvinist punitive God, he wanted to invert the formula and be as loving and present and engaged a parent as his own had been remote. So he took the kids to Europe as soon as they were able. I mean, Henry and William, when they were under three, went to Europe. And then there were five children, William, Henry, Garth Wilkinson, Robertson, and then Alice. And he hauled them back and forth across the Atlantic for 15 years in search of a perfect education that existed only in his own mind.
What happened to the other two? Why aren't they as well remembered as the three we're talking about?
One of them said when they were in school in Switzerland that they were foundlings. They somehow didn't have whatever the genetic inheritance it was that meant you were a James. They were not intellectually engaged in the way that Henry, William, and Alice were. They were, in some ways, it looked as if they were off to a much more conventional success in life. Both of them fought in the Civil War, which neither Henry nor William did, and their father was immensely proud of them. The elder one was wounded with Colonel Shaw, the regiment of Robert Gould Shaw with Massachusetts 54th, which could not have been a more heroic thing in abolitionist Boston. But they just never got it together to do much of anything.
Now, why did Henry bring his kids to Europe? Weren't there places in the United States that would provide a good education?
There were, but not the education he had in mind. He wanted them he kept changing his mind. When he was in Europe, he wanted to come back to America and did, and then he would haul them all off back and forth. But he wanted them to be exposed to culture, art, music, literature, foreign languages. They all learned French. They became quite good, especially including Alice, at speaking French. And the variety of human experience that he didn't think could be gotten in America until he was in Europe, and then he thought we needed America again.
But he didn't send Alice to school. He sent the boys.
He did. The whole point of this family and the education he had in mind was about education, sensuous and academic. And he didn't think girls needed to be educated. Girls and women in general, his wife and her sister who lived with them, were virtuous by nature, and he thought that woman's purpose was to educate man and keep him moral and good and honorable, and that men struggled with the conflicts in their nature and the nature of good and evil in the universe, but women were set aside from all that because they were so good by nature they didn't have any of these problems.
What did she do while her brothers were at school?
She often had a tutor or a governess. When one of the younger brothers was still home, Robertson, they shared a tutor or a governess. And she learned French. She learned to play the piano. She took walks. But she felt very much excluded from the activities that the older boys, that the boys, period, were able to engage in. They could walk freely around Paris and London. She had to be always with someone else. And their father, although the boys went off to these, probably 10 schools by the time they were 15 years old, which they all complained about afterwards, and having been hotel children, being pulled up by the roots every 4 or 5 months
and
to
they
try hard, something.
And they couldn't really bond with other kids.
They couldn't. They
couldn't make real friendships.
It really created a family unit, you know, because that's, they had each other to rely on only. Henry said of William that he was a native of the James family and had no other country, which was in some sense true of all of them.
But it sounds as though they had a happy childhood nonetheless, and you tell a story about Henry Sr. not being able to keep secrets around Christmas time.
Yes. There's a wonderful passage in one of Alice's, it's from her diary, I believe, later on, but she talks about how he and his wife would hide the presents in the closet upstairs, but she said the delicious infant couldn't bear to not sneak the kids into the closet and show them their presents before Christmas when their mother was out. And she said, I can't remember the exact language, but something about how excited and thrilled he was and how he ruined Christmas for them every year.
Now, what about the mother? Henry wrote about these authoritarian maternal figures in his novels. Was their mother like that?
It's very hard to see a real picture of him. Mary James, her name was Mary Walsh James, because they all sanctify her in everything they say. She was patience, she was wisdom, she was exquisite maternity, she was the keystone of the arch, Henry said. And Alice pretty much echoed that. All of her children and her husband suffered terribly with emotional and some physical troubles as well. She had no sympathy with that and not much patience with it. Her sister Kate was the one who took care of whoever happened to be an invalid at the moment. William at one point described her as healthy-minded, and it wasn't entirely a compliment. It was sort of like she was as strong as a little buffalo carrying out the tasks while her children were languishing all around her. Henry, although he paid lip service to patience, wisdom, exquisite maternity, he never drew a portrait of a mother in his fiction that is anything like that. They're mostly evil, vulturous creatures feeding off the souls of their innocent children, either letting them go off to terrible fates like the mother of Daisy Miller, or they're conveniently dead before the story starts, or they're actively evil.
My guest is Jean Strauss, who's written a biography of Alice James, wrote it actually 30 years ago.
Do we have to say that?
Well, you won the Bancroft in 1980. That was nice. You've done many things since.
I have. It's just a long time.
Nothing to be embarrassed about, but this is a wonderful book. And one of the things you have to deal with, one of the great mysteries, is the relationship between William and Alice, which sounds kind of, well, it sounds like it was almost incestuous.
It's very interesting. Yeah. And I don't mean to be, I'm not embarrassed by it being 30 years. It's just a long time. But I'm thrilled to have this book out again after so long. And also, it's rather astonishing to read a book you wrote 30 years ago.
What happens when you read it? Do you think, oh, gee, I wish I'd written that sentence differently? Or do you think, gee, that was terrific. How did I do that?
Well, we'll get back to the question about incest and William and Henry. But it's part of what's been really a pleasure about this is their language. They're so rich and playful and funny, and it gave me so much as a writer. It made me a much better, I mean, I learned how to write in doing this book, and there it was terrifying, of course, to try to think I could have anything to say about them, but I was able to stand on their shoulders. There are a few things I would change. I think there are places where I go on a little too long about the nervous diseases that Alice suffered with, trying to explain the failures of her life. But on the whole, I'm having a very good time rereading it. I'm almost finished. But the incest is a very interesting question with William, and then in a different way with Henry. William teased Alice. He was the oldest. He was physically more adventurous than Henry. He was out in the world. He would write sonnets to Alice about how he's asking her to marry him, and if she refuses, he will drown himself in the sea. And he's always referring to her physical attributes, that he longs to kiss and hug her and hold her in his arms.
And he drew pictures that some people will see sexual imagery in.
I'm not sure about that. He certainly drew pictures of her, and his language was very suggestive.
And then he married a woman named Alice.
And then, yes, that. And he married a woman named Alice in 1878, and his sister was 30 years old at that time, and she had the most severe nervous breakdown of her life in that year. It was all very well for him to talk about other women, which he did all the time, and to flirt, she had really, I think, thrived on his attention at the same time as it was embarrassing and odd to be treated. She didn't know how to respond, really, to these sexual implications from your brother. Is that okay? Is that not okay? The family was laughing. It's embarrassing to be at the center of that family gaze for this reason. But then he marries another woman who's healthy and who's got the same name, and Alice, the sister, is therefore canceled out, I think, in her own eyes.
Well, she referred to marriage as the most proper occupation for a woman of her time,
mm-hmm.
never married. Do we have any sense of why? Did she have an interest in men? We're talking about now about William getting married when she was 30, mm-hmm. so she's already considered a spinster in
Very
that society.
So. Yes. She was interested in it. She was fascinated as her friends began to pair up. She was also envious, and she was a very sharp critic, very sharp writer. And on this subject, the sharp point of her pen has venom in it. When she's constantly belittling either the men her friends marry or the women chosen by men she admires. There was one man whom she really had a crush on named Charles Cabot Jackson, but he was in love with a woman named Fanny Appleton. And she writes a fair amount about him, and I think she would very much have liked to have a conventional family herself. She just, I think, emotionally was not available.
But she also was ill much of her
yes.
life, although it seems to be slightly psychological, what they
More
called
than
hysteria.
Slightly. Yeah.
Was she ill from the time she became marriageable on?
Even earlier. It started when she was about 12. She had a kind of becoming Victorian delicacy that so many of those women did. She was invited to visit Emerson's daughter in Concord, and for some mysterious reason, they don't actually talk very much about what the symptoms she's experiencing are. She had some sort of breakdown that weekend and couldn't go. She was excitable. She was faint. She had fainting spells. Her stomach was a problem. Her legs were a problem. It was that weird morass of symptoms that Freud talked about in 1895 in Studies on Hysteria.
Was this reflected in her writing?
Her illnesses?
Yeah.
She talks about it. She talks about the sufferings of this mysterious these mysterious ailments. But she sees it as a struggle between her body and her will. And she determines that her will is going to triumph.
Now, she doesn't begin writing in her diary, which was published posthumously, until she was 40, just 4 years before she died. What had she been doing all those years before?
She wrote letters, and because they were James's, people saved the letters. So there were a lot. That was a wonderful resource for me. She, during the Civil War, she and several other Cambridge, Newport, and then Cambridge girls got together and organized a sewing bee that was making bandages and shirts for the soldiers. And they kept going, actually, after the Civil War as just a sort of social and socially activist group. She, in the 70s, she and several other Boston women formed something called the Society to Encourage Studies at Home, which was one of the high points of her life, actually, because it was using what she had, which she was a passionate reader all her life. She had access to books. She had access to ideas. Being at that family dinner table was like going to Harvard. Thackeray, Carlyle, Emerson, people just came for dinner and everyone was talking about ideas. So for Alice and these other Boston women, they basically were conducting correspondence courses with women in California and Florida and Arkansas and Arizona who had no access to great universities and libraries. They were teaching these other women what they did have, and it gave her a sense of value that I don't think she really found anywhere else in her life.
She does write about the years preceding the time she starts working on the diary. Do you think she wrote the diary with the thought that it might be published someday?
I think so. There are different voices in diaries. This one is addressed to posterity. And for Alice to risk writing in that family of extraordinary writers was a very dangerous thing to do. But she had a voice, and she knew it. And in the diary, she finds it.
Well, she had been ill, as you said, since her breakdown when she was just a teenager. But that illness is not what killed her.
No. No. She was diagnosed at the age of 44 with breast cancer. And it's an extraordinary moment in her life. She's actually thrilled to have a serious medical diagnosis rather than all these vague nervous ailments of neurasthenia, hysteria, rheumatic gout, all of the funny and meaningless names they put on the things that were troubling her. She calls this cancer in her breast, she calls it this unholy granite substance in my breast. If that's not a Jamesian way of putting something, I don't know what is. And she rises up to meet her death in the most extraordinary way, and it's sort of the high point of her life. She goes out to meet it like a lover whom she's been waiting for all of her life, and talks about it in a very forthright way. William writes her a letter when he finds out about the diagnosis. That's a long, really sympathetic, thoughtful, empathic response to her. And she says, "I'm so glad you walked right up. You walked right up to my demise and didn't, you know, pussyfoot around in any way." And then they have this extraordinary conversation about death, which is probably the 19th century was better than we were, but the Jameses were better at it than anyone.
Jean Strauss is the Sue Ann and John Weinberg Director of the Dorothy and Lewis B. Cullman Center for Scholars and Writers in the New York Public Library, the author of a number of books, including Morgan, American Financier, and the one we have been discussing, Alice James, a biography, just reissued by New York Review Books with a preface by Colm Choi Bean. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.